Okay, we're talking to Mike Summers, who was a newsman at Wacky in Louisville. During what time?
That would have been from 1969 to 1971.
All right. And where were you before Wacky?
I had only worked at a couple of other small stations in the Louisville area, and I'm from Louisville. So I grew up listening to Wacky, which is one of the reasons it was such a kick to work there. I worked at a little station in New Albany, WREY, which was right on the main drag as you entered New Albany, Indiana. And there I did a board shift in the morning, and then I also did news in midday while I was going to college. After that, and overlapping that, I worked at a station in St. Matthews, WSTM-FM, under another name, overnights, playing easy listening and jazz and so forth. But my real start in radio began, oddly enough, with junior achievement. When I was in junior achievement in high school, I was involved in a radio company. We produced a radio show once a week, a 30-minute public affairs show, and that was done at WAVE AM. There, I met someone, sort of a mentor in radio, who was an announcer at WAVE, Dick Morant. Dick had worked at a little station in Jeffersonville, Indiana, with Burt Markert, both playing, you know, beautiful music and so forth. And Burt Markert later became Weird Beard at Wacky and played an entirely different kind of music. So I think the connection between Bird and Dick might have helped a little bit in getting me a job at Wacky. I don't know, but I sort of just walked in the front door. I knew there were changes going on, and I'd heard there was a new sheriff in town and that Wacky was changing, and I just walked in there and asked to cut an audition tape.
Okay, what kind of changes? Changing from what to what?
I don't recall exactly what the format was before. What had happened was that I heard that Bob Todd had arrived and that Al Smith was the general manager, and that there was going to be some sort of a format change. And I also heard that that might mean openings. I don't think there was even a formal opening. I just sort of walked in the door, but I knew at the time that I walked in that I would probably not be playing music, and I really was interested in news at the time, and I thought, well, this might be a golden opportunity. Maybe they're going to be adding some people to the news department.
Wacky was a top 40 station through all the 60s, as far as I know, so probably they were just retooling the station.
Yeah, that's the rumor that we had heard, and of course, the big thing at the time was Bill Drake in this more music format, and people were starting to pay more and more attention to it, especially WKLO, and then I knew about Johnny Randolph having KLO experience. I knew that there was going to be a big fight between the two, that it was going to be a ratings battle. And it turned out to be for about 3 years there. It was great.
So Wacky and KLO really got serious about one another during that time.
They really did. You know, first of all, you had both of them with showcase studios. And you have to remember, in Louisville, on a summer night with a top down in the late 60s, that's where it was. It was driving by the showcase studio and hoping to get the attention of the disc jockey that was in there. Everybody was listening, of course, and hoping that maybe he would acknowledge you or say hi or whatever. That drive took you right by KLO studios and then right down 4th Street past Wacky. And for somebody like me, walking in with very little professional experience other than these two low-power stations, walking into an environment where, you know, some big boys were in town who knew what they were doing, were going to change the programming, they had some ideas and so forth. Even being able to sit in that showcase and fill in a couple of times, you know, on a board shift was incredible. You're sitting there with spotlights on you and people lined up out front looking at you. It was fabulous. It was like going to a network as far as starting in the news business. It couldn't have been a better place to start.
All right. What shifts did you work starting out as a news person? Were you afternoons, mornings? What'd you do?
Well, I worked all shifts there. I worked for a while with Bailey in the morning, which was quite an experience. And, you know, that was an honor to be able to watch a pro like Bailey or to be able to work with Burbank. And I did Burbank's news in the afternoon for a bit there. And then I worked in midday with Dude Walker as well. So I've worked various shifts at night sometimes and on weekends. But the experience that I was getting was invaluable. I worked for a news director, Bob Watson, who later went on to work for the Associated Press, who just mentored me through the entire learning experience. So you never had a typical day at Wacky. I mean, you might be covering a trial, you might be covering a fire, you might be covering a news conference, a plane crash. You learned by doing. I mean, you went out and you were given instruction, and he just sort of guided me along in delivery and in presentation and so forth. He was great. That's something I really don't think you could find today, a situation where you could walk in and have somebody pay that much attention to you and pass along that much information. Must be able to work alongside these pros, you know. There were times when you were distracted having to do the news because somebody would pop their head in and say, did you hear what Burbank just did? And and you'd be annoyed because you knew that if you were at home, you know, you'd be listening. But you had to do the news, and you didn't have time to listen, and you missed a lot. It was a real kick to be surrounded by it.
What was the news approach at Wacky? Wacky is generally thought of as a top 40 more music radio station with lots of personality. But when it came to the news department, which we really haven't covered up until this date, what exactly was Wacky's approach to doing news? How did it differ from, say, WHAS or WAVE?
Well, it was a top 40 station, and it was top 40 news. So, yeah, it was breaking. It was urgent. There was a lot of traffic. It was, you know, of course, school closings when the weather was bad and so on. They had a couple of real heavyweights under Bob, Byron Crawford, who later developed a following as a columnist for the Courier-Journal and Louisville Times, worked at WACA. In fact, he was just leaving around 1969, I think, when I was arriving. So it had a great news image. We were very lucky after we went to work on a long-form documentary on race relations called Soul Searching. It was a 30-minute radio documentary without a script or narrator. And Bob and I produced that, and it got a lot of attention. It won several national awards and so forth. And the station was nice enough to not only put it on during their regular public service block, but to repeat it in a better time slot when people heard it. And this was a pretty rough documentary. I mean, this was something that openly discussed the N-word, and again, in the late 60s in Louisville, and it was a pretty turbulent time. And the station got some attention for it and got a really nice write-up. And I think that that documentary and the attention it got and a couple of others just solidified the image that it was a station that offered you everything and that it wasn't going to slight on news in any way whatsoever. So whether it was information you wanted or entertainment or traffic or sports or whatever, you know, they had it covered. I think that's why they were as popular as they were.
What was a typical day like for you as a news person? I assume a few hours a day was spent covering an air shift, doing the news for a particular air shift. But what did you do when you were on the clock but not on the air?
Well, you were running around in these, at the time, in this little five-speed Saab that Wacky had as their mobile unit. I had one of the first mobile phones in the city. That was unheard of at the time, and it was about a 50 or 60-pound radio that was installed in your trunk and so forth. So we were able to cover news outside, and my time was sort of halfway between the outside stuff and the documentary production inside, or series production inside. As I mentioned, you know, when you're starting like that, you don't have any idea. You're a general assignment reporter. You don't have any idea what's going to happen next. You're just sent out and dispatched to wherever the news happens to be breaking.
At that time, had cassettes come into form for news gathering, or were you guys carrying Wallen sacks out?
No, we did have cassettes, thankfully. These little Sony portable cassettes that made everything a lot easier, and good old Electro-Voice 635 microphones, you know, that you could hammer a nail with and would still seem to work somehow or another. All of the stuff we had was pretty much indestructible. And you still, of course, were feeding things through the phone using alligator clips or tapping into a phone and trying to mix on the air if you could. It was a lot different, a lot different than it is today. I later went to work at CNN, and we would get perfect audio emailed to us. And we would actually email audio from China or from Thailand or something, and it would sound perfect. And I used to think back about these alligator clips and the trouble we used to go through with cassettes and batteries running out and so forth.
Most radio stations I've worked for, especially in the 70s and 80s, it seemed like the newsroom got the worst equipment in the building. Was that true at WACA?
Well, not really. We got quite a bit of support from the news department, and I think they recognized the commercial value of the news department, too. So it wasn't entirely hand-me-down equipment. A lot of it was homemade. A lot of it was built just, you know, our homemade board or homemade this or that, built just for the job that we had to do. And, of course, you had in those days, too, this assortment of scanners, and very few of them had crystal control over the frequency. These were tunable police scanners that wandered off frequency every so often. So one of the actual jobs in the morning, in addition to making all the rounds calls and checking in with the police department, was to get up behind the scanners and try and tune each and every one of these radios to see if they were on the correct frequency for the day, because they would drift during the day as all the heat built up. You know, you're listening to dozens of different radios at the same time.
How many people were in the WACA news department?
I guess we had four or five at that time, and maybe a couple of people part-time. At its height, it was a pretty busy department. Again, not only because of things like the documentary things, the extra stuff that was being done, or a little series, you know, multi-part series, it just covering the day's news, covering the breaking news. That was also a tough competition with WKLO. We were at them constantly to beat them in news, just as we were trying to beat them on the air in entertainment.
Were you aware of the other stations in the market, like HAS and WAVE?
We were, but not to that extent, because their formats were so entirely different. You know, we were trying to carve out the top 40 area. I don't know how much you may have talked about Skinny Bobby Harper, who was at WACA for a while, and it was also here in Atlanta at Quixie. But to give you an idea of where WACA was in terms of creativity and so forth, Skinny Bobby would essentially write his entire show before he came in the night before. He would block out two or three solid hours, and he would do it with these multicolored pens and bring in under his arm a pot of coffee, which he'd put on a turntable and turn into a Lazy Susan. And he'd sit down and do this hilarious radio show. And the most of it was blocked out, but sometimes things would just pop up that he would pick up on. He was just brilliant to watch. Well, we were talking about the fact that WKLO did its traffic with a little announcement called Traffic Condition Red. And a news guy would come in breathlessly, and he would say, Traffic Condition Red, injury accident at 4th and Broadway, avoid that area. And then as it started to clear, then he'd come in, you know, half an hour later and say, Traffic Condition Yellow, you know, there's still some tie-up, but they're clearing that accident. And then they would actually come in and say, Traffic Condition Green, saying it was that it was okay to drive there. And Bobby and I and Johnny Randolph and others would talk about this back and forth with Mason Dixon as well and say, well, you know, how silly is this? And why do you need this color coding? And why do you need to tell people traffic condition green? And I told Bobby, I said, you know, we ought to have a guy that just comes on and says traffic condition chartreuse. And immediately Bobby Harper said, go do that. Just go do that on a card and we'll just pop it on. So I went back in the production room and I just did this very effeminate, you know, traffic condition chartreuse. And then we did traffic condition mauve and traffic condition magenta. And we did a half a dozen different colors on there and went after KLO. It was just a little bit of gamesmanship. And it became, to Harper, as soon as he heard it, he said, well, that's Officer Bruce. We'll make this Officer Bruce. And he would tease Officer Bruce coming up with a traffic report in 20 minutes. And, of course, all you heard was Officer Bruce saying traffic condition magenta. I mean, you never heard any traffic any traffic information. But we knew that it was just another little sick. It was just another little shot. You knew the people at KLO heard it. You knew that anybody who heard their traffic condition red had to smirk, having heard this the previous morning on Harper's show. So it was just a little bit of gamesmanship that was going on. And this sort of thing was going on constantly between the two stations to see what the buzz was on the street, who was up, who was down, you know, who was winning.
What do you think about Bill Bailey?
I just love him to death. He was amazing to talk to. He made it look very easy, you know, particularly compared to somebody like Harper who put all this preparation to it. Bailey walked in, sat down, as he said, with his box of Teeny Bopper records and went to work. And he took advantage of the showcase studio. And so he had this ongoing rapport with people who would wander by outside to wave and so forth. And you'd hear a one-sided conversation between Bailey and some of the people on their way to work. He was so easy to wake up to. And I know that there were probably people that had a love-hate relationship with him that just couldn't listen to Bailey, maybe because of his voice or delivery or whatever. I just thought he was just an incredible talent and had a great sense of humor. And Bailey and I would occasionally lunch at Kunz's, the Dutchman, which is when, of course, Bailey was getting off for the day. So that was his 5 o'clock hour. And he was ready to party. Well, it was, you know, noon or 1 in the afternoon. There was an entire day left for a lot of us. But Bailey prided himself on the fact that he didn't hang around long for many meetings after his shift. He did it well and got out. He was great.
Okay, Dude Walker.
Dude was wonderful. I got to do his news for quite some time there and a couple of different time shifts. Dude was one of the most giving people. Very few people knew how involved he was with charity work, particularly the St. Jude Children's Hospital. He is, I think, originally from Memphis, or at least had spent a lot of time in Memphis, and was very involved in their fundraising efforts and so forth. He was wonderful, and then the last I heard from him, he was briefly in Tennessee when I was working in Chattanooga, and then I believe went back to Memphis and got involved in television in Memphis.
Gary Burbank.
It was such an honor to ever have an opportunity to work with Gary because, again, that was one of those situations where you really would rather be in the master control room watching him work than you would in the newsroom putting together the show because you knew there was a genius at work. He was almost schizophrenic at times with Wonder Mother and all the voices and the bits that he did. It was almost spooky. You know, it was like stream of consciousness. There were times when I really wondered whether he knew what was going to come out of his mouth, and maybe he did too. I don't know. But it was always funny and it was always entertaining, and nobody had any doubt that he would just be enormously successful, which he was. I mean, there was never any doubt in watching him and the way he worked and the way he treated his job and so forth. He's one of the hardest working people you'll ever find in broadcasting, I think.
What about Johnny Randolph?
And Johnny Randolph was the team leader, and he brought with him, you know, all sorts of information about KLO and the thinking at KLO. So that was great in a ratings battle to have somebody who worked for the competition and who knew all the people over there and knew how they thought. You know, I talked to him about programming one time, and he said that the success of a top 40 station really wasn't, you know, a handful of big items, but it was a million tiny little details to get it right. And he was good at that, and he was good at handling that and having a vision for how much to talk and how much not to talk and how much music and how to present it and so forth. And he had a great taste for Louisville's music taste. You know, Louisville's a very big R&B town, and Wacky was a heavy R&B station. And I think he had such an ear for the music that was going to work and what wasn't going to work. I'll tell you a story about Johnny. I worked with the Weird Beard as well at night. And, of course, this was when the cruising was underway. This was when all of the teens would cruise along the 4th Street promenade there to wave at Weird and say hello and hope that he'd mention their name on the air. And he had a fondness for banana milkshakes. And one night, he went to the back door of the station to pick up a banana milkshake that somebody was nice enough to bring by. The door closed behind him, and he locked himself out, and he was the only one there. At the time, I was rooming with Mason Dixon, maybe 20, 25 minutes away. The two of us had been living together in an apartment out off Preston Highway. And so we're heading into Mason's midnight shift, and I think I was going to be on the air the next morning and was going to sit in with him overnight while he did his show, and we're not hearing anything. It's dead. And we keep tuning, and we keep checking, and we're not hearing a thing, except it's just a carrier. And, of course, Weirdbeard just standing outside with his banana milkshake. So we finally show up and find Weirdbeard, and he's in a pay phone booth behind the radio station talking to Johnny Randolph, who was about 10 or 15 minutes away, explaining that he was locked out and explaining that he needed a key to get back in. And then Johnny showed up. We all sat around sheepishly and walked in, and Johnny finally showed up and bailed us out. But he has a million radio stories, and radio runs through his blood. I mean, Johnny Randolph loves radio, and he understands it, and he was just immensely helpful.
All right, let's talk about Weirdbeard.
He was great, and I mentioned earlier his relationship with sort of my mentor over at Wave, Dick Morant, and the two of them worked in a very conservative environment. I mean, they played beautiful music. It was Mantovani. They were both learning radio at the same time. Well, Weirdbeard, when he came to Wacky, was just that. He was weird, and he was supposed to be weird, and he dressed weird and acted weird and had a weird beard, and that was the whole persona. And it was odd because after I got the job at Wacky and had been working there for a while, Dick Morant came by to visit. And to see this sort of reunion of these two very straight announcers, with one of them still with his Wave uniform on and so forth, and the other one, you know, in tie dyes and long hair and a beard screaming at the top of his lungs and so forth, Weird was just a solid hit. He was enormously popular, and he was on in exactly the right time slot. Weird blew the roof off the place. He played rock and roll into the night the way Wolfman Jack would. And he took no prisoners. He was great.
Mason Lee Dixon, I guess you probably know a lot about Mason Lee after rooming with him.
I do. Mason and I roomed together, as I mentioned, for a while, and he really prompted an interest for me in astrology, oddly enough, because he was very involved in astrology and the occult, and he used that to his advantage on the air, too. You know, he did a sort of a Rod McEwen kind of late-night show in which he actually not only took calls occasionally, but he would do astrological forecasts, and he would work those in and out of the music and so forth and try and tie them to the music. He was just a wonderful fellow, and I lost track of him over the years. He went to St. Louis for a while at KXOK, I believe it was, and then I went on to another market, and we got out of touch, but I've heard that since that he's back in Louisville. He's such a talent. He's another one who made it look so easy. You know, he could sit down, open the mic, and you wondered where it came from, but it just looked like he'd been preparing all day.
Bob Todd.
Well, Bob and I have reconnected, actually, about 2 years ago. After I left CNN, I went to Florida for a year and worked with Bob and his video editing and marketing company in Ocala, Florida. And Bob really was one of the keys to making the whole change there. And he was one of the people involved in hiring me along with Bob Watson in 1969. And Al Smith, the general manager, and Bob had worked before together and knew each other well. And I think they did a great job. Bob, I'm not sure if he ever did an air shift. If he did, it would have been only a brief period of time and probably 1 or 2 hours a day. But I think he was almost entirely an off-the-air programmer. But when Bob left Wacky with Al, both went to Chattanooga and got a top 40 station there that was almost exactly a repeat of the Wacky KLO fight. It was a small station trying to take on a big entrenched top 40 station that, in fact, was one of the two stations, I think, ever owned by Ted Turner at the time. And that station hired one of the sales managers from Wacky, oddly enough, so it was a fight royal all over again, with Bob programming the station, I was the news director, and then Al was the general manager. So another aspect of the business, of course, is you keep bumping into the same people in different markets at different times, and, you know, you have to quiz them. Where were you in 1971? Where were you in 68? So forth, to find out what markets they worked in.
How would you describe the contrast, if any, between Bob Todd's programming styles versus Johnny Randolph's?
Well, I think Johnny was a lot looser in terms of how far the jocks could go. You know, I wasn't involved that much in the meetings and so forth on that side because I was in news, but you knew that there was this constant debate about more music or more talk or how to do both and how to do it well. And I think the reason for Wacky's popularity then was it sounded fun to listen to. And it sounded like a fun place to work. And it was a fun place to work. And so both of them had the philosophy that it was what came out of the speaker that mattered, that nothing else really was important except the final product. And the final product, if you listen to it side by side with KLO, it began to be more fun. Even though it had a very solid news department and had garnered a lot of respect in that area and so forth, there was a sort of an air of craziness about it. And more, WKLO sounded almost robotic. It really sounded Drake. It sounded like flip cards and music and more music and more music, and there was very little personality allowed. So there was a distinct choice that people had, and they preferred the people that sounded like they were having fun. Because they were. You could tell it. You could tell we were having fun.
Okay, after you left Wacky, why did you leave, and where'd you go?
I left because I had an opportunity to go with Bob and Al in Chattanooga and become a news director and sort of build a news operation essentially from scratch, which I did for a few years. And then I went to New Orleans, where I worked as a co-host of a morning news program down there at a news talk station, WGSO. From there to Baltimore, Maryland, I was a news director for 5 years at WFBR in Baltimore, and then I finally wound up in Atlanta at CNN Radio. I was a news anchor and producer and an editor at CNN Radio for 10 years, and then I left broadcasting a few years ago and went to CNN.com, the website of CNN, as a writer and a copy editor. And then I left the news business last year and have since taken a job as a communications specialist. I work in the healthcare field here in Atlanta.
Well, you've had a cool career there.
I've been busy, but Wacky was the best of the best. It really was. Of all the opportunities, including CNN, I don't know whether it was because I was from Louisville and grew up listening to Wacky or whether it was the first real, solidly professional group of people, you know, that I had a chance to learn from. But it was just great. There were so many very talented people during that brief period that I was there, and they all went on to great things. And you were like a sponge at that time in my life, in my early 20s. I was just soaking up as much as I could, just watching these people trying to figure out how they did it, and I did it well.